Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Heather Bishop. Bishop is one of Canada's most well-known performers and activists. She is one of the first Canadian singer-songwriters to navigate a career of international scope entirely as an independent, producing, marketing, and distributing her own work through her Mother of Pearl Records, which she began in 1976. In the late 60s, she was also the first woman to form an independent feminist movement, and the late 70s found her taking on the rights of Aboriginal women and eradicating homophobia. Bishop also studied fine arts in college and is a well-known painter working mostly in oils. She's produced 13 CDs, including her most recent, My Face is a Map of My Time Here. I'm speaking with Heather Bishop by phone from Canada. Heather Bishop, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, the pleasure's mine.
Now, I want to start with the fact that you began as a visual artist, even studied fine arts in college. Tell us about your discovery of art as a means of expression in your early days.
Well, you know, it's interesting. As a child, I always instinctively knew that I had to be creative to kind of survive. And then one time I had my chart done, and it turned out that just about all my planets were in my creative house. And the woman said, you better be creative with your life or you're going to be really stuck. So when I graduated with my degree in visual art, I thought I'd pursue that and quickly discovered that it was a very hard way to make a living, and so I switched to music. I don't know what I was thinking.
But you did pursue painting, and
yep.
I read that you had a love affair with oil paint and have all your life.
Yes, indeed. And I did keep painting until life on the road as a musician really took over. So there was a period of 20, 25 years where I didn't paint at all, but it was always in my heart and in the back of my mind that I was going to go back to it. In fact, I promised myself that when I couldn't stand touring anymore, I would paint again.
Mm-hmm. Now, some of your most recent work you have included in your new CD, Beautiful Portraits of People. Were you always interested in the human face?
I was. You know, for me, people's faces, hence the title of the album, people's faces are such maps of their time here. And, you know, when you look into a twinkling pair of eyes or you look at a face where you can just see the laughter or the sorrow or, you know, all the things that person has gone through, I feel like, you know, those are badges of honor on your face. And for people who would have facelifts, I think, don't take an eraser to your face, please.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel the same way about that, yeah. Now, of course, you did go on to discover music, and especially in the late 70s you began. How did you discover that? Did you start writing songs? Did you pick up an instrument? How did that come about?
Well, in the very early 70s, like 1972, my partner at the time and I started a women's band, and which was a pretty radical out there thing back in those days. And our name was Walpurgis Night, and I wasn't the singer. I was the guitar player and the keyboard player. And then our singer quit, and we needed a singer, so the rest of the band kind of pushed me forward, and I began singing. And we toured all over Saskatchewan, playing every kind of gig you can imagine. And often people would book us by name, and we'd show up at the gig, and they'd think we were the girlfriends. You know, they're like, "When does the band arrive?"
Wow,
honey,
that is the early days, huh?
Yeah, and we had some very interesting experiences. I'll tell you, some people were not too crazy about it being an all-women's band. But, of course, as the night went on and the prairies being what they are, people got a little drunker. They didn't care so much.
What kind of music were you performing in those days? Were you beginning to write at that point?
I hadn't really started writing yet. We were doing, because it was often small-town dances and things like that, you had to do lots of old-time, which is the music I was raised on. So we would do polkas and schottisches and waltzes and all of that. And then as the night wore on and the audience really got lubricated, then I would start to sing the blues. And, and then people were like, "Oh, yeah, man, that's so cool."
So you must have been influenced at some point by the American women's music pioneers, right? Because you began to write political stuff. And
Yeah, you know, I was heavily involved in the women's movement anyway, and as well as that, I was out. You know, I came out as a lesbian in, you know, whatever, 1971 or 72. which was an outrageous thing, as you can imagine then as
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided, because in truth, the musicians that really influenced me were Buffy St. Marie and Nina Simone, both of whom are women of color, of course. And what it did for me, being this little white girl from Regina, is they taught me so much with their music, and I grew just from listening to their music. And I thought, boy, if I'm going to do anything with my music, that's the kind of musician I'm going to be. I'm going to be somebody who speaks about my truth. And then the music is more than just music. Not that just music isn't enough, but mm-hmm. for me, it was a vehicle. So when I deduced that, I thought, well, your career will last 5 minutes. But what happened, which was a very interesting thing, actually, because my first big concert as a solo artist, you know, I did a song called I Found a Girl about falling in love with another woman. And I expected, you know, it was a show of about 1,000 people in the audience, and I was totally expecting to be kind of booed off the stage at best. But I ended up getting a standing ovation, and I was shocked and surprised and thought, well, maybe this will work. But what it did for me was, with every gig, it was another new surprise. And then came the time, well, I think I'll make an album. So rather than going into the business and always feeling like, well, how come I didn't do better, you know, because the music industry can be very hard on you.
Absolutely.
You know, people who are really talented don't get anywhere. So I never, ever had to walk down that street, because I always knew that anything that came was a gift.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a fascinating way of looking at it. And being influenced by Nina Simone, indeed, would help you to seek that truth in yourself and not be afraid to speak it. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, she was quite amazing. Now, do you find art and music entirely different forms? Is that why you have had to separate them?
No, not so much. Well, different in the sense, of course, music is so public. I mean, while you're creating, you're in front of people. And when I mentor young musicians, I say, you know, you're going to make all your mistakes in front of lots of people. Mm. There's nothing private about it. And the piece about that I think is so powerful is that, for me at least, when you become a very powerful performer is when you are able to unzip your heart and invite your audience in, which is, you know, when you get off the stage, you feel very vulnerable and exposed, and you go to the, what have I done kind of place. But indeed, that's the way that people really get touched and moved by what you have to say, and you're speaking your truth. And ultimately, I think there's a common thread to all of our truths, no matter who we are. And if you're willing to share your truth, then that will resonate with someone else and give them courage as well. Whereas when I paint, I actually enjoy the privacy of it. You know, I get in my little studio, and I can just wallow in the process, if you will. I just love just sitting there and painting. And then when I have a show, then I feel really exposed. Like, what if nobody likes my painting? You know, so it's really different in that way.
You know, putting anything forward to the public, painting or music, is a vulnerable position to be in. I've talked to a lot of women performers about that, that vulnerability that happens, and that's necessary, it seems.
Yeah, I think it is. Music or art or creativity, no matter what your creativity is, because I think we all have it, is a gift, I feel. And so from those to whom much has been given, much is expected. You need to give back with it. And if it's, you know, when I started out, when we were young and full of, we're going to change the world, I didn't really believe, you know, I was hoping for the best, but I wasn't sure how much change we could actually make. Now, 30-some years later, when I've been singing about being a lesbian on the stage for all these years, I have seen the change that it's made. Like in my country, of course, marriage is legal and you get same-sex benefits all the time, and you don't even have to be married. Common law, same-sex couples are recognized all throughout the country. So I have been able to, and in fact, I was given the Order of Canada, which is the highest order this country awards, because of my work trying to change the world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, 30 years ago, if you'd have said that I would be getting such an award for the same things that they were trying to put me in jail for 30 years ago, I would have said, you're full of it.
It's so remarkable, isn't it?
It's remarkable that in a short 30 years, that there's been that much change. So, you know, I feel like if you don't think music can't change the world, I'm here to tell you you're wrong.
I agree with you. Now, let's listen to an excerpt from your latest CD, My Face is a Map of My Time Here. I want to play a cut called Ancient Cry. It's so beautiful. Tell us about this.
In my life, I was invited into the Aboriginal community at a young age, like in my very early 20s, and that community affected me and had a huge impact on who I am as a person, and I've been blessed with that connection throughout my life. Back when I wrote that song, which now is, time goes so fast now, at least 15 years ago, there was what was called the Oka Crisis in Canada, where the government was going to take another piece of the First Nations people's land to make a golf course. And the people stood up and said, "That's it. We've had it. You're not. This is a sacred piece of land to us." This was in Ontario. "You're not going to take our land anymore." And so they barricaded a highway. My government, to its shame, sent more troops. It was when the Gulf War was going on. Sent more troops against those people than it did to the Gulf War.
Mm.
At the same time that that was happening, all across this country, at our legislative buildings, which are like our Capitol buildings, Aboriginal people set up peace camps on the lawns and invited all four nations to come and pray for peace with them. And I just thought, now there's the real leadership. And one of the things that happened with that I've seen happen in my own life is when a major attack happens like that, it often affords people who don't get involved to get involved, because you kind of go like, "Hey, wait a minute. You don't speak for me when you do this."
Mm-hmm.
And I heard people phoning into radio stations, white people who wouldn't perhaps have ever taken a stand, phoning up and saying, "This is wrong what we're doing. We shouldn't be there doing this." And so I woke up in the middle of the night with this song. It's one of those songs that came to me. It's a blessing. I feel like it was just given to me. I had my catcher's mitt on and caught the song and wrote it. So and I feel blessed that it came to me.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of it.
There's a cold wind wailing and a full moon waning. Spirit of the old ones come to claim their own. Drums echo on waters that the white man would claim. Waters that were given in the chill.
What a haunting and beautiful song it is, Heather. Really, it's so touching.
I quite love that song, and I've seen the effect that it has on people. In fact, the first time I sang it in Australia, an Aboriginal woman from that country came up to me with tears just streaming down her face, and she said, "That's also the story of my people." And so she and I connected and became friends, and the following year, when I was back touring her country, I was at the Woodford Folk Festival. It's their biggest folk festival, 80,000 people, beautiful festival. And she sought me out and she said, "Heather, I've been playing that song for the elders, and they've asked if you would join a conciliation circle with us and sing it." Mm. I mean, I was totally floored. So I sat in the circle on the sand in the 40-degree heat, and they sat me beside an elder by the name of Uncle Peter. And so came time for me to sing the song. I began singing it, and as I did, he picked up his didgeridoo and began to play with me, and I had an out-of-body experience. It was unbelievable.
Mm, mm. If you're just joining us, my guest is the Canadian singer-songwriter and activist Heather Bishop. Now, Heather, let's talk about this other stream that we have touched on that has run through your life, and that is activism. My understanding is that you were one of the first women to start an independent feminist movement in Canada. Tell us about those days in the 70s.
Well, I was at university in 66 to 69, and that's when the second wave of the women's movement was really getting going. And I was in Regina at the time, and there was a hotbed of political professors, lucky for us.
Mm.
So the left was going full tilt boogie, and a bunch of us women in the left were going, excuse me, we are not the knitting circle. And so we began forming the independent arm of that, and out of that came, for us in Canada here, came the second wave of the women's movement. And to me, the first time anyone even presented the idea to me, it was like, well, duh, of course women are equal. Like, I was fortunate enough as a little girl, both my grandfather and father are master carpenters, and as a little girl, my father taught me carpentry. But the thing he really taught me was, you can figure this out. You can do anything. And so when I stepped into the world that said, oh, no, you can't, I went, oh, yes, I can.
Mm.
And so to me, it made perfect sense that I would fight for those things and move forward with the idea across the board that we needed equal rights. So we began doing things like, there were no rape crisis centers. There were no daycare centers.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
There were no shelters for battered women. So we began doing all of that, and we were in the forefront of getting abortion legalized in this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, when was it legalized in Canada?
Wow, you're going to ask me for a date now, which I can't give you. I'm sorry, but mm-hmm. it's many, many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And not without great controversy, but, and they always keep threatening, of course, depending on whether or not we have a conservative government in place, but they've learned to leave it alone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's sort of like what it is in this country, as you probably know. Now, you also got involved with the LGBT movement, obviously. Was that just an extension of the women's movement, or did you actually start a gay alliance in Canada?
Well, it was interesting because when I found, like, first of all, when I was a lesbian in the women's movement, and we had to keep our mouths shut
mm-hmm.
because we were going to give the movement a bad name.
That's the same thing that happened here in the U.S.
Yeah. So it was hard for us to find each other even within the women's movement. But there came a time for me when it was like, I have to find other lesbians. I have to. So I started looking around town, and somebody told me a bunch of dykes worked at the car wash. Anyway, I finally found a connection, and there was a club. It's like, wow, a club. And I found this, it was a place you had to walk through a huge weeded yard to get to, and all the windows were boarded up.
Oh, yeah.
It was very, dangerous and clandestine in those days. And up until that point, I had never felt particularly like I was a sick person. It's like, whoa, wait a minute. And the other thing that I had assumed was, of course, all the women are going to be feminists, aren't they? I walked into this club, and it was like stepping into another universe. And it was like, wow, it blew my head. So so I was also bringing feminism into the gay community, and I immediately, as soon as I found that community, I was one of the very first to. We started talking to the police. I started talking to cadets in the police, saying, "You have to stop beating us up. You have to start protecting us." I went to university classes, especially psychology classes, and talked to them about, "Please stop using shock treatment on us. We are not, you know, we are not unhealthy people. And I started going on the radio. And it was, you know, no one had ever done this before, and it was really quite outrageous. And in those days, every religious zealot would call up and quote Leviticus to us.
Mm.
Go, Lord love us. So they were wild and hairy days.
Yeah, they were. They were in most of our countries, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God we have gone past that.
Yeah.
Now, before we run out of time, I do want to play another excerpt from My Face is a Map of My Time Here. I want to play a cut called I Remember It Well. Can you tell us about that? It's a sweet tune.
Yeah, it kind of harkens back for me. My musical roots, because I come from a rural country kind of culture, was the old-time music, and I have always had a soft spot in my heart for it. And when I was writing the songs for the new album, this little snatch of a melody kept going through my head, and it just, for me, it was like, yeah, I'm not, you know, I just turned 60, and I'm moving into my cronedom, if you will, and that melody takes me back to where I come from, and the sweetness of remembering all those times was where the lyrics came from. And I'm a grandmother now. I have three grandchildren, and I wanted to leave them a little piece of that too, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's listen to a little bit of I Remember It Well.
My memory's a melody from long ago. A fleeting dream, it always seems to come and go. The sweet, soft refrain of a child's carousel, lost in thoughts where I find. I remember it well. Goes la 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 la. La 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 la. I love the little ones, it's so much fun to watch them grow. They humble me with their joie de vivre, ever be it so. But when their little hearts break, then such stories I tell. I hold them and quietly find I remember it well.
What a sweet piece. And it does take you back to the past, especially when you do that lovely humming.
Mm-hmm. And see, and I love to dance. Old-time dancing, look out. You know, for me, that's a really good time. And I find that kids today don't dance as much. So I am totally determined to get my grandchildren dancing.
I think that's it's a great thing for your soul to do that.
Absolutely.
Now, you know what? I think of you as a true Renaissance woman. You're a carpenter, a plumber, an electrician, an auto mechanic. You built your own solar home in 1979. Tell us about this other side of you. Is that part of your environmentalism?
Well, it's very much a part of my love of the earth. Also poverty is the mother of invention.
Mm-hmm.
I was a musician, and of course you make no money, and I really wanted my own home, and I had, you know, I had these carpentry skills. So I went to night school and picked up my electrical skills, and a friend who was a plumber said, as long as you remember that shit runs downhill, you'll be okay. So that was my plumbing training. And we put it all together, And I before I built it, I did a lot of research on a lot of different things. One, I read this book. My bedtime reading was Goodbye to the Flush Toilet. You know, so I really researched all the ways in which to make my footprint on the earth smaller, and built a solar house that I still am in, and for me it's this mansion that's filled with sunshine all winter long. I can heat my house for $500 a year, you know.
Wow.
What could be wrong with that? And, you know, now, of course, a lot more people are looking towards it, but I wish a lot more people understood that it costs no more money to build a solar house, and it's one of the most beautiful homes you would ever live in.
Well, was that difficult for you to find the materials that you needed back in 1979 for an environmentally conscious home like this?
I recycled a lot of stuff. My house is built on recycled hydro poles, and back then they were made of BC cedar, so I have these massive, they're probably 14 inches in diameter, hydro poles, and when you strip them down, strip the gray off, they're this beautiful, rich cedar. So it's built on these poles, and I built double stud walls, which means you have basically two outside walls. So my walls are 14 inches thick. There are 44 in the walls, are 80 in the ceiling. Your vapor barrier is on the outside of your inside wall, so it never gets pierced when you put in the plumbing or the wiring. So you've got a tight-fitting, well-insulated house, and it's just, it's a dream to live in.
Wow, that's amazing. You are an amazing pioneer. I want to talk to you a little bit, as long as we have a little bit of time. You formed your own record company, Mother of Pearl Records, in 1976. What were the struggles around that? How did you do that?
Well, I you know, when I started getting a bit of a reputation here in Canada, a couple of guys approached me to produce me. And it actually scared me because I knew that the one thing I wanted to be the most true to in my music was the message. For me, it's always been about the message. The music is the vehicle. And I was scared that I would get watered down or talked out of doing things. And I ran into a fellow musician who encouraged me. He was starting to put together a little studio of his own, and he said, you know, why don't you make your own, form your own company? And I thought, wow, great idea.
Mm.
So I formed the company, and, you know, at the time I begged and borrowed from, you know, at $200 a piece kind of thing, $3,000, and went into this little 8-track studio and made my first album. And it to rave reviews, which also shocked me, and that was the beginning, and away we went from there.
That's remarkable. Now Heather, we do only have another minute left or so. Are you writing any new music about any particular issues?
I just have come out of a big writing period when I wrote for this CD, and so now I'm back on the road. I had taken a couple of years off the road because I really was quite, you know, for 30 years I was gone 10 months of the year, and I really wanted to be home. And, you know, now that I have grandchildren, that makes a difference as well. So I came home and started painting. But now I have the new CD out. I'm back on the road again, and I'm struggling to try, because I really am into the painting now. So I'm struggling to find time to paint and balance all of that. So I had set aside the time to write, and now I'm promising myself that I have this new series of paintings that I want to start on right away. So that's where I'm going next, is back to the easel.
That's great. Can you give contact, a website?
Yes, it's heatherbishop.com. So it's just my name, .com, www.
Great. Well, Heather Bishop, it has been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for doing it.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.